Welcome to Speaking in Maine on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, a public affairs program dedicated to bringing you speeches recorded from around the state, given by experts lecturing on topics from environmentalism and sustainability to the global economy, politics, and beyond. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today's program will feature the University of Maine's 2015 Senator George J. Mitchell Lecture. The talk, given by University of Colorado professor and author Roger Pelkey Jr., is titled When Science Meets Politics, Symphony or Slugfest. His talk will be followed by remarks from Senator George Mitchell. Here now, introducing the speaker, is David Hart, Director of the Mitchell Center on Sustainability Solutions.
So it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Roger Pelkey Jr. to the University of Maine. With degrees in mathematics, public policy, and political science, Roger is an accomplished researcher as well as a prolific and engaging writer. Throughout his career, he has asked how science and technology can help us respond effectively to the challenges and opportunities involved in creating a brighter future for humanity. He has received numerous awards for his work, including an honorary doctorate from Linköping University in Sweden and the Public Service Award of the Geological Society of America. Roger has applied his keen intellect to a wide range of challenges, including such diverse issues as natural and human-caused disasters, world trade, climate change, and professional sports. A central theme in this work is the nature of interactions among science, policy, and politics. As he will explain today, there are multiple roles that science can play in society, and each role has different benefits and costs. By examining the trade-offs of these different roles, Roger's work can help us create a healthy balance of approaches to evidence-based decision-making. His work also reminds us that, just as with the protection of democracy itself, we must remain eternally vigilant in examining and safeguarding the role of science in society. You sometimes hear academics portrayed as scholars cloistered in their ivory towers, disengaged from society. But I think it's safe to say that no one has ever had this caricature in mind when thinking about Roger's work. Because he has focused on many thorny issues about which people care deeply and often disagree strongly, he has sometimes been on the receiving end of professional as well as personal criticism. Of course, this is to be expected because academics who work on important but controversial issues must be prepared to endure slings and arrows. When my colleagues express understandable concern about being criticized in the public sphere, I remind them that one of the best ways to minimize the risks of such discomfort is to work on problems that nobody cares about. I'm happy to report that they, like Roger, have opted for the lesser of two evils. They've committed themselves to wrestle with messy, real-world problems despite the bruises. Indeed, Roger's work underscores the extraordinary opportunity that scientists and other scholars have to engage with society in the search for solutions. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Roger Pelkey Jr. to deliver the Mitchell Lecture.
Thanks, David. Senator Mitchell, President Hunter, thank you so much. It's great to be here. It's great to see so many students. I'm a professor. I have PowerPoints. I can go on for hours and hours, but I guess people have to get to class and to a reception, so I'm going to jump right into my talk today. So I have a single focus. And the focus is, how do we get good expert advice in highly politicized settings? And the stories I'll relate to you today are that we love experts, and sometimes we love experts a little too much. We need experts. We need experts to make society work, to make wise decisions. But sometimes we don't well use experts. So how do we go about doing that? Let me start with an opening story. This is about genetically modified organisms, agricultural biotechnology, and the chief scientific advisor of the European Commission, who was Ann Glover. Ann Glover was appointed in 2011 as the first chief scientific advisor for Europe, And she would often go out in public, as she saw as part of her job's popularizing science, and explain to people that the scientific evidence did not suggest that genetically modified agriculture was in any way dangerous. So here she says, this is from Science Magazine, by all means, people can say for ethical reasons, for philosophical reasons, for economics, for politics, I am not keen on that, on GM food. But you cannot say it's dangerous when it isn't. The president of the European Commission, José Manuel Barroso, was asked, do you agree with your science advisor? And he explained, the science advisor has a purely advisory function and no role in defining commission policies. Therefore, her views do not necessarily represent the views of the commission. So you have a science advisor. She gives you advice, and you say, we don't listen to anything she says. Don't you worry. Soon thereafter, a number of nonprofits, interest groups, civil society groups, wrote a very prominent letter that this is after Manuel Barroso was leaving office. Jean-Claude Juncker was coming in as the next president. We hope that you, as the incoming commission president, will decide not to nominate a chief scientific advisor, and instead will take its advice from a variety of independent, multidisciplinary sources with a focus on the public interest. I wonder who they might be thinking of. So, leading to much discussion, incoming President Juncker, he junked the chief scientific advisor. So the website was archived, and Glover was asked to return to Scotland. And right now, the European Commission is in the process of establishing a new committee to deal with scientific advice. But this example illustrates some of the challenges. When scientists and other experts bring information that may be viewed as politically uncomfortable or inconvenient, a lot of times what we do is we say, thank you, expert, but we really don't need your advice. It's not just in Europe, of course. Republicans in the U.S. Congress have decided not to support gun control research. There's an epidemic of violence in this country, and Republicans have said, no, we don't want to research that topic. They're opposed to that research. And it's not just Republicans. The Obama administration has a unit inside the State Department that every year produces assessments of the degree to which different countries engage in human trafficking, slavery, illegal work practices. As part of the negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade agreement that's going on, reportedly, according to the media, the Obama administration asked its experts in the State Department to change some of their ratings so that some countries that were judged to be engaged in trafficking were determined not to be, in order to facilitate passage of this particular legislation. Again, experts are great, but when they get in the way, that's a problem. So conventional wisdom, how we normally think about these things, particularly in academic settings, is there something out there called the truth? Scientists are trying to reveal it. Politicians often are trying to cover it up. Now, what I'm going to suggest in the next little bit is that this view of conventional wisdom is oversimplified. Reality is a little bit more complex. And if we're going to deal well with experts in politics and improve the use of experts, we need a more nuanced, a more sophisticated understanding of the relationship of knowledge and action in politics. So in last week's issue of Nature magazine, I would encourage you to have a look at it. There's a wonderful article on how scientists fool themselves and how they can stop. And there's a number of cognitive issues which arise from psychology, from pressures on publication, and so on, that lead to knowledge that's being published out in the scientific community being less than reliable in many instances. So an example, a group of psychologists, through kind of an open source approach to science, selected 100 different psychology papers and tried to replicate them, tried to reproduce their results. And when they did that, they found that only 39 of the analyses they looked at could be replicated. And of those, only about 4 were virtually identical, which has prompted a kind of a crisis of confidence in how we do research. How can it possibly be that we publish research and then it turns out not to be replicable, not to be true? This happens in medicine, too. The drug company Amgen looked at 53 cancer studies, tried to replicate their findings, could only replicate six of them. Economics, this paper is just out last month, looked at 60 studies in economics journals and found less than half of them could be replicated. So when we talk about peer review and publications as the gold standard for knowledge, it turns out that peer review is a fairly low bar. Now, let me suggest that the crisis that science is facing now with replication is a subset of a much larger issue we face. And I'm going to introduce a term called an excess of objectivity. So in a very interesting study that has just recently also been reported in Nature, a group took a data set, and it happened to be red cards given to European soccer players. They gave the data set to 29 different teams, and they asked those teams, can you investigate this data set and tell us if red cards, which is kicking a player out of the game, are given to black players at a higher rate than to other players? Right? Very straightforward question, a very simple data set. So what happens is, and I know you can't read this, but each of the black boxes refers to a variable selected on the left that the different teams decided to use in their analysis. So you can see different combinations of variable: position, height, age, country, what club they play for, does the referee matter. The different teams assembled their analyses, and you can probably see where this is going. They came up with a range of results. My good friend and colleague Dan Sarowitz from Arizona State says science is sufficiently rich, diverse, and balkanized to provide comfort and support for a range of subjective political positions on complex issues. Let me illustrate this a little differently. So here's the results that these teams came up with. So the graph on your right, you see a dotted line going up and down. If the dot and the associated uncertainty doesn't cross that dotted line, that means they found an effect. If the uncertainty bar crosses the dotted line, they had to reject the idea they found an effect. And the two groups at the top found that black players received fewer red cards than other players. So it's possible to provide this set of answers to someone, and they can select among these results to find out whatever answer they want. So imagine you're in a legislature, and instead of red cards at players, you're talking about GM foods or some other topic. This is the point that Dan Sarowitz was illustrating, that there's a range of results that are plausible in science, and that diversity of views allows science to be readily mapped on our existing political debates. So what's true here? What's the right answer? It's a very hard question based on these results. So let me give you a more practical, real-world example. This involves me. In 2008, I was invited by a prominent company to participate in an expert elicitation. So in the world of insurance, you have insurance companies that will sell you and me policies. They bundle them all together, and then those companies buy insurance on their portfolios. That's called reinsurance. Big companies, it's insurance for insurance. In that industry, the rates for hurricane cover are determined by how they judge the frequency of future hurricanes to be. So I was invited as a panel to participate in a panel of experts to be involved in an expert elicitation to help a major company come up with a projection of future hurricane rates to help set pricing in that industry. All right, so we gathered in South Beach, Florida. Here's the experts here, our facilitators. And the way that it worked, they gave each of us a little bag full of 100 tiddlywinks. You guys know what tiddlywinks are, little tokens. And the experts, there was eight of us, each got to allocate tiddlywinks across computer models based on our expert judgment as to which one best represented the future incidence of hurricanes. And then they took the tiddlywinks, added them up as weights, and then used that with the models to come up with an estimate of future occurrence. Doesn't matter what the company is, so I blacked out the information. This is an old story, and the details don't matter. Here's the models we were given. Here's the 5-year incidence of Category 3, 4, 5 hurricanes from these different models to hit the United States. There's 20 different models. You can see a wide range, and I hope you see the analogy to the red card case. But when I was there, one thing stood out to me as very interesting. I'm going to put a red line on this graph that's going to show the historical average hurricane incidence. Now, you don't have to have a PhD in statistics to understand what the relationship between this red line and the models is. Every single model we were given has a rate higher than the historical average. So this got me thinking, what exactly were we doing in this exercise? So the experts weighed the models. It was averaged. The results came out at 0.92 per year, Category 3, 4, 5 landfalling storms, the most powerful storms. And I said, well, what would happen if instead of a bunch of PhDs, they got some chimpanzees to play with these tiddlywinks and allocated them at random? What would the results be? The random weighting came up with 0.91. So what we were being asked to do was really a function of the input that we were given. The experts were window dressing. Now, this is interesting, and the process you might critique a bit, but it has consequences. So Paige St. John is a reporter. She used to be at the Sarasota Herald Tribune. She got a Pulitzer Prize for her series on reinsurance and moved on to the LA Times, which is what happens when you get a Pulitzer Prize. And she looked into this process, and here's what she concluded. This is in 2010. Instead of using 120 years of history to calculate the average number of storms each year, a new approach would estimate storms for the next 5 years. The change, so because the estimate of risk went up based on those models, created an $82 billion gap between the money insurers had and what they needed, because with higher risk, you need higher premiums to cover your expected losses. That was a hole they spent the next 5 years trying to fill with rate increases and policy cancellations. This is the change that led to record high Florida property insurance bills. So $86 billion was transferred from Florida residents to the reinsurance industry, and it just so happens that $82 billion is the identical number to the first estimated losses from Hurricane Katrina. So our work with the tiddlywinks led to economic impacts on residents of Florida equal to Hurricane Katrina. This, I would argue, is not the best use of experts. And since 2005, a Category 3, 4, or 5 storm has not hit the United States. So it was not a particularly good exercise. Now, Stephen Colbert coined this term truthiness, which I think deserves a greater place in our discussions of science and politics. Truthiness refers to things that we think of as true because we want them to be true. Wouldn't it be nice if the world conformed to our values, our expectations? Unfortunately, it doesn't. Now, let me give you a few examples of truthiness in politics. This is Senator James Inhofe. He was on the Senate floor one snowy Washington day with a snowball explaining that climate change was a hoax. Now, of course, a snowball on the Senate floor doesn't counter results from years of research into increasing global temperatures. Here's Al Gore with a picture of Hurricane Katrina making an opposite point about a weather event and its relationship to climate change. Unfortunately for Mr. Gore, hurricane incidence in the United States is down by 20% since 1900, so is the intensity, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says no robust trends in the annual number of tropical storms, hurricanes, and major hurricane counts have been identified over the past 100 years in the North Atlantic Basin. So when I show these two slides, I hope you have the reaction. You have two reactions. One is you think, ha-ha, that guy, whichever guy you pick, is a fool. And the other one makes you feel a little uncomfortable, right? That's true. That's the feeling of truthiness, right? Boy, I really wish that that guy didn't say that, or that guy must be right because I agree with him. It's a challenge. Now, there's a lot of talk that goes around about politicians of this stripe or that stripe being anti-science. And I would argue to you that I don't think I've ever met an anti-science politician. Politicians love science. They love it to death. This is John Gummer, who was the Minister for Agriculture in the UK, today's Lord Deben, during the time that the mad cow disease broke out. This is him appearing on national media with his daughter, eating a hamburger, to illustrate to people the safety of the beef supply. We now know that there was a crisis with mad cow disease. In 2011, I was on a panel with Bill Foster, who was then a member of the House of Representatives, lost his seat, and now is back. And this was a panel on research ethics with young scientists. And this is how I wrote it up on my blog at the time. Representative Foster said that scientists should expect that the information they bring to the political process, such as through testimony before congressional committees, will inevitably be distorted in the political process. He then raised what he called a difficult ethical question. If a scientist knows that their message will be distorted in the political process, to what degree should she or he pre-distort their message in hopes that what comes out the other end is a closer approximation to reality? And he said, if your political opponent says the answer is 5, and you well know the answer is 0, maybe you should go before Congress and say the answer is -5. I told the students gathered that I did not find that to be a difficult ethical question. Now, one of the challenges is that when we ask people their views about science, we're not really asking people their views about science. This slide comes from Dan Kahan, a psychologist who works at Yale University, who's done some of the best empirical work on public opinion on science and expert topics. And I'll just quickly show this. The graph on the left, so blue is liberal Democrat, red is Republican, shows the difference, or in this case, the lack of difference between Democrats and Republicans on questions of general scientific knowledge. Turns out that Republicans and Democrats as a whole generally have similar ability to understand scientific questions. However, on the graph on the right shows when they're asked specific questions about climate change, you get a sharp difference between Democrats and Republicans. Now, what Professor Kahan concludes from this, and I think there's pretty strong evidence for it, is that when you ask people questions about climate change, the reply they give you is not a reply about what they think about science. It's a reply telling you who they think they are, that issues of science get wrapped up in our identity. So when you ask people about climate change, they think of a lot of things other than radiative forcing. You can contrast that with issues like pasteurization, right? If you ask Republicans and Democrats about the science of pasteurization, not a lot of difference. It's not a highly politicized topic. But there are some issues, fracking, genetic technology, and agriculture, climate change, where the issue is more about politics than science. It's important to recognize that all efforts to communicate and engage are political. We resist that, particularly those of us in the academy, because we think that we can rise above the politics and focus only on the facts. And it turns out that's really a challenge in a lot of settings. Now, individual scientists have gotten wrapped up in the politics of issues. Here's a very recent one. Kevin Folta is a professor at the University of Florida. He does strawberry research. He's an advocate for the use of genetic modification. Long story short, a number of anti-GMO interest groups did Freedom of Information Act on his emails, recovered something close to 4,000 of his emails. In there, it was revealed he had relationships with corporations, which in agricultural schools you'll find, and also found that the University of Florida had received a $25,000 donation from Monsanto. The result was a front page story in the New York Times very directly accusing this professor of wrongdoing and suggesting he was an improper participant in the debate. What I found remarkable, Nature Biotechnology, one of the leading journals, issued a strong rebuke to the New York Times. This is not how the New York Times is usually referred to. This is how demagogues and anti-science zealots succeed. They extract a high cost for free speech. They coerce the informed into silence. They create hostile environments that threaten vibrant, rare species with extinction. The vibrant, rare species is the scientists willing to go out in public and engage. Now, I can tell you that if it's a battle between individual scientists and the New York Times, the individual scientist is probably not going to come out very well in there, whether their science is good or not. And this will lead to where I'm going, which is the importance of institutions at the science-politics interface. I've had my own experiences. So I testified before Congress in 2013 on the science of extreme weather, presented some of the same data I showed you on hurricanes, and as a result of that, a member of the House of Representatives investigated me, suggesting, wrongly, that perhaps I had received funding from the fossil fuel industry. But if it's me against a member of the House of Representatives, you can guess who wins in that debate. But with all of that, you might think, well, I really don't like politics. But let me tell you, thank goodness for politics. Politics is how we get done the business of society. As often as I can, I repeat this from Walter Lippmann, the famous commentator of American politics of the 20th century. It's a paraphrase, and he said, the goal of politics is not to get everyone to think alike, but rather to get people who think differently to act alike. It's not our job in the political sphere to enforce a uniformity of view on scientific topics or political topics. Collective action requires that people are allowed to think differently, but we find ways to overcome those through collective action. Now, let me introduce a concept of wicked versus tame problems. If we have an axis here of conflicting values, increasing uncertainties, in my book, The Honest Broker, I talk about tornado politics. If a tornado, as rare as they are in Maine, if it was approaching this building, if we wanted to evacuate to a shelter, the science would be enough for us to decide, right? If it's headed toward this building, we're going to the shelter because we share values. Where we share values, we don't see values. I contrast that with abortion politics, which there's a strong values dissensus in this country, and no amount of science is going to help resolve that question. We can expand it. Maybe climate change has conflicting values and high uncertainty, economic growth. Most people seem to like it, but it's unclear how we get it. There's a class of problems that are wicked. These are problems that are difficult. They're characterized by our lack of ability to ever find a solution, but rather we do better or worse. Tame problems are technical problems, pasteurization of milk, evacuation from a tornado. We often try to shoehorn wicked problems into the tame problem framework and say, well, if only people were given more facts, the tornado's coming, they would take the right action. But if it's a wicked problem and you give people more facts, and you believe Dan Kahan's research, we're just allowing identity politics to take root in the context of science. So I had a chance in 2007 to write a book called The Honest Broker, in which I tried to map out a simple framework for thinking about how we can navigate this contested terrain, where science is uncertain, values are often contested. And I came up with this four-part framework, and it has a theoretical background, but I'm going to illustrate it to you through an example. So, this is actually a cry for help. Where should my wife and I have dinner tomorrow night? We're going to Bar Harbor, right? So in this example, I want you to pretend like I'm from Colorado and pretend like you're from Maine. You're the local expert. I'm the decision maker. And I'm going to give you four ways we could have an interaction over this very important question between expert and decision maker. And obviously, this is an analogy for bigger, more important issues. All right, so here's the grid. One thing you might do is you might say, hey, I don't want anything to do with your values-based decisions about food. People from Colorado, they eat weird food and don't know anything about seafood. So what I'm going to do is give you the 2015 dietary guidelines from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This is science. This is pure science. I'll give it to you. This will empower you to make a good decision about where to eat. Right? So as a I'll return to this in a second, but as a practical matter, it really doesn't help, right? Because it doesn't tell me where the restaurants are, what's on the menu, how much it costs. That's the pure scientist. The pure scientist tries to stay out of political issues. If we take that literally, then the pure scientist isn't engaged with decision makers. Another mode of engagement. You could be like the concierge at a hotel. I could come to you and say, could you recommend three places on the water that serve lobster? You could probably say, well, I can recommend 35. But the characteristic of the arbiter is that the decision maker uses the expert as a resource. Right? I don't ask you, where do you think I should go? I ask you questions that can be answered empirically, that is, with the tools of science. That's arbitration, science arbitration. Another mode might be, you tell me where you want me to eat. You say, well, and I pick McDonald's here. Maybe you have stock in the company. You have a nephew who works there. You really like the food. But you really want me to make that decision. The defining characteristic of the issue advocate is an effort to have the decision maker reduce their scope of choice. So let me say that again. So your job as an advocate is to try to get me to converge on a decision that you prefer. And we see this in elections all the time, right? You want someone else to vote for your candidate. You're trying to reduce the uncertainty of that decision. Now, the honest broker of policy alternatives is at the other end of the spectrum. And I've illustrated that here with a guidebook, right? So there's a difference between pointing me to one restaurant versus giving me a book that has a list of restaurants. Now, at the end point, the honest broker is useless, because if you gave me the yellow pages, and yeah, my students ask me, what are the yellow pages? But if you gave me a telephone book full of restaurants on coastal Maine, it would be useless, because we would probably starve to death by the time we figured all that out. Honest brokering involves some commitment to value, some winnowing, but I would argue there is a huge difference between empowering me to make a decision with a guidebook versus telling me to go to a particular restaurant. One of the things to recognize about honest brokering, and this gets to one of those messy democratic questions, is that you are empowering the decision maker to make the quote-unquote wrong decision according to the expert. You might think you know the very best restaurant in Bar Harbor, but by giving me a guidebook, you're saying that responsibility and accountability for the decision is yours. That is a difficult one when we come to very messy questions like vaccination of children or action on climate change. Each of us has to decide where we draw that line between empowering decision makers and advocating for certain courses of action. Let me say, all of these roles are important in society. We need this whole grid to be filled out. One is not more important than another. They're all valuable. But I will say, in some contexts, some roles are more important than others. Let me go back to the food guideline and get back to the truth question. So which food line food guideline is the best? So I got one from Australia. Is it the Australian guideline? You might say, well, that's quite similar to the U.S. guideline. It's a funny-shaped pyramid, but that's all right. But what about the vegetarian food pyramid? Should meat be part of the USDA recommended diet? Well, the USDA is in charge of advancing economic interests of farmers and healthy diets. And it turns out, this is from last week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said sustainability is not going to be a consideration in their food guidelines. So the question of meat, they're going to step away from that. I would suggest that the idea that there is a pure science out there somewhere is a lot more difficult to find than we might think in practice. Now, a challenge that faces the scientific community and leads to a lot of the pathologies that we see is what I call stealth issue advocacy. This is the fifth category. Right? We represent ourselves as experts as either pure scientists or science arbiters. Oh, I just talk about the facts. I'm here for the facts. But really, we're advocating a particular outcome. Instead of getting science into politics, what that does is it brings the politics into the science, right? So when you have that red card situation with 29 different studies, if you say, well, this study is the truest of them all, and it leads to a certain outcome, it could be that you are advocating for a particular action through science. And if I know one thing, that is, if science and politics come into conflict with each other, it won't be science that wins out. So I hope through this quick survey, you get a sense that the relationship of science and politics is far more complicated than truth speaks to power. As experts, we need to have open discussions about what our role is and recognize we have choices in how we take on those roles. And those choices are a function of how we think about democracy, how it should work, and the role of experts. I often tell my students, when you get in an airplane, we don't engage in stakeholder engagement to decide who's going to fly it. We say it's the woman or man with the pilot's license and the nice hat. They're going to fly the plane. Right? But there's many other settings, like the siting of a waste plant, where you want to have full citizen engagement. And there's a difference between those, and we have to engage. It's not a matter of just having everyone understand the truth. Now, let me say, as I get to closing, that here at Maine, you have a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. In my book, I argue that there is one of those four quadrants that is really an endangered species. It's the honest broker. It's very difficult to have honest brokering done. Experts love to advocate. We like to use our expertise as a platform for pushing for answers. Politicians don't want people to give them options, right? They don't want people to show up and say, well, you can do this or this. Harry Truman said, I want a one-armed economist to avoid the on the one hand, on the other hand, right? So honest brokering can't really be done everywhere. Not only do you have a wonderful center focused on solutions, which itself is fairly unique in the university landscape, but you have, as one observer put it, the personification of the honest broker in residence in your state. There's probably... I can tell you that there is no shortage of people out there in the scientific community and elsewhere telling us what they think we should do. There are very few places that you can go where people will tell you what you could do. And that's an important distinction. So I encourage you every success in your search for solutions, and I hope that as part of that, you will expand the search for solutions rather than try to narrow it down. A lot of our environmental sustainability questions are gridlocked because we lack new and innovative options, not because we haven't won a political battle. So let me conclude. If you get nothing else from this talk, here's the bottom line. It's really important to openly discuss roles and responsibilities when scientists engage with decision makers in the public. It's not just about science communication. It's not about speaking more clearly or loudly about your science. There are multiple possible roles. It's not that one is better than another, but you can make better or worse choices about what role you take. Honest brokering is really difficult. There are very few institutions where it's possible. When it comes to engaging in politics, I like this quote. It says, you can't swim without getting wet. Don't enter the political sphere and say, I'm only going to talk about the facts and stay above. You need a strategy and a plan for how you engage with people when you present results. If you're the European science advisor, or you're the State Department with a report on fracking, or you're advising Jim Inhofe on climate change, the politics are going to show up. Individual scientists can't do it alone. Institutions matter. If it's the politicians and the New York Times and Fox News that are coming after scientists, scientists won't win unless they're organized and have a plan for dealing with the politics. You can reach me, pelkey@colorado.edu. I love to get feedback and hear from you. Here's a website where you can find some papers and discussion, and I look forward to answering a few questions.
So, just one comment. In northern New England, wicked is not an adjective, it's an adverb. It's a wicked high province. That is not wicked province. But a bigger question is, are there some tame problems that started as wicked problems? and became tame. Like vaccinations, non-controversial vaccinations back in the day, or pasteurization when it was first introduced. The telephone as a technology was going to ruin society 100 years ago. And it's now, you know, we're talking about text messaging the same way. What happened? How did they change from wicked to tame?
Yeah, this is a great question. And a short and simple answer is technology. So vaccination, in fact, did start out as a wicked problem, a wicked hard problem. vaccination was resisted early on. There was political opposition. And we saw like a little taste of this earlier this year. And when the effects of vaccination began to be seen, the politics changed. And you could make the case that earlier this year, when we started to see the debate and, you know, a little bit on the left, a little bit of the right, opposition to vaccination, some theories about that were that we have lost the ability to see what vaccines do. We live in generations where the diseases that vaccines have an effect have always been with us, right? We don't see polio like maybe our parents or grandparents did. And so it's much easier for the politics to take root when you don't see the effects of a technology. I'll give you another example. Chlorofluorocarbons. So in the 1970s, ozone depletion became an issue. You had environmentalists and industry on opposing sides. Very familiar story. HCFCs, hydrochlorofluorocarbons, were invented, which didn't have the ozone-depleting properties. They have other problems, but set that aside for the moment. And all of a sudden, environmentalists and industry were on the same side. We don't want the ozone layer to be destroyed, and industry wanted to advance selling a new product. So technology, and I'll credit Dan Sarewitz for this insight, technology does something that science cannot. Technology can do something. It's not about what you believe, and you can see its consequences, and that is a much better base for organizing political action. So I've taken this insight in the context of climate change and suggested instead of arguing about the science of climate change, we ought to be arguing about the deployment of low-cost clean energy. We're starting to do that, I think, in the debate, but you can still see a lot of places where we argue about the science.
Other questions?
When does it, like, a certain role, one of the four roles that you mentioned, can turn a tame problem into a wicked problem through, like, a Cobra effect?
Yes, all right, so let me say that those four roles, they're very contextual, right? On one issue, you could work as an honest broker, go out to lunch, come back, be an issue advocate. It's not something that is like a fiber of your personality. And let me also say the honest broker role is not well suited by an individual. It is best suited by a committee of people with diverse views. You want that committee not to reach a consensus, but to achieve disagreement on what the options are. One of the valuable functions of the honest broker, I think, is to help try to turn wicked problems into tame problems. Right? So the technology, HCFCs, in the ozone issue, the new option that was introduced to the policy debate allowed the politics to reconfigure in a new way. Often we take the political world as fixed. There's those guys on the right, those guys on the left, and it's always going to be that way. The first champions of solar energy, the biggest champions for solar energy in the 1950s were the Republicans. I'd like us to start thinking about politics as being much more malleable than it is. And one way to do that is to reconfigure problems and options. So this is why I think honest brokering is so essential to a well-functioning democracy. Sometimes the Madisonian view of different factions out there competing, leading to good action, breaks down. And we need experts not to tell us what to do, but to introduce options that allow the politics to move forward.
I think we're going to need to stop there, so let's thank Roger again.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce George Mitchell to you today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
When I travel around the country speaking, I've learned that Maine has a special place in the minds and the hearts of people everywhere. And they have a mental image of Maine. Many of them have come here, many not. And so I'm asked when I speak. Just two nights ago, I was in Wilmington, Delaware, and at the reception, someone said, well, I hope you're going to tell some Maine stories. And I do tell Maine stories, not in Maine, but I want to tell one here, because Rogers and his wife are going over to Bar Harbor tonight, and they're going to hike and go to a restaurant in the time that they're there. And so it reminded me of a story that I would like to tell, because it represents the part of what we like to think of as the Maine image, one aspect of which is the wily Mainer outsmarting the loud out-of-stater who comes here. And this is a true story. Many of you, I'm sure, most of you have been to Acadia National Park, and you know within the park there's a very nice restaurant, the Jordan Pond House. Roger, this is a subtle advocacy. I think it's the upper right-hand corner of your graph, where there's a nice restaurant on a ridge and there's a beautiful lawn sloping down to the Jordan Pond. And I helped, the original building burned down, and I helped organize the funding to replace it with the current building. And after the summer after it reopened, I went there to meet two friends of mine, a guy from Portland, one from Bangor, to do some hiking and to have tea and popovers on the lawn at the Jordan Pond House. And so the fellow from Portland and I got there, and we waited, and the third one didn't show up. He's from Bangor, so we didn't know whether to start, whether to go for a hike or what. So we decided to call him to find out if he's on the way. So a few years ago, so they had payphones then out by the entrance to the Jordan Pond House. We went out, and there was a guy standing at the payphone, and he had a card propped up with a bunch of numbers on it, and he was pumping quarters into it, banging the side of the phone and cursing and yelling, and his wife was standing nearby, and he was saying a lot of unkind things about Mainers and yokels and so forth and so on. So I stood there with my friend, and the line got a little bit longer, and we were there in embarrassed silence at this spectacle. And then the guy behind me tapped me on the shoulder. He said, excuse me, aren't you Senator Mitchell? I said, yes, I am. He said, oh, I'm from Bangor. He said, I'd like to shake your hand. I supported you. And I said, well, that's real nice. We met. He told me his name. And then he said, are you here on vacation or are you working? I said, well, I'm here on vacation with two friends. We're just going to do some hiking. So the polite thing to do is I said to him, are you on vacation too? No, no. He said, I'm working. He said, in fact, I'm working right now. I said, you're working right now. What do you do? He said, I'm a telephone repairman. He said, when that guy from New York runs out of quarters, I'm going to fix that phone. Well, there are many restaurants, but the Jordan Pond House is really nice for afternoon tea and popovers. I know we all listened with great interest to Roger's talk, and we appreciate the important work he and his colleagues have been doing to strengthen the contributions of science to the political process. We live in a world in which science and technology increasingly play important roles in shaping our lives. Just think off the top of your head how we travel, how we communicate, how we acquire information, how we care for our sick, meet our energy needs, grow our food, design our cities, manage our forests, all influenced by science and technology. And yet, it's also clear, as Roger emphasized, that science can be manipulated to serve particular interests. And scientists themselves can get caught in the crossfire that occurs during public debates. So it's easy to understand that there are some scientists who shy away from tackling controversial issues because it will draw them into political disputes. But, like Roger, I believe interactions between science and society need to be increased and strengthened. And what his talk did was, I think, provide a very valuable context within which to evaluate that. Science will always play an important role, increasing in this century, including in the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake, for diagnosing the causes of complex problems facing society, in particular medical problems. We're on the verge of, I think, solving many, many of the cancers that have had such an effect on human life. Research and development for new technologies that make our life easier. When I served in the Senate, and in particular the years I served as majority leader, I had many experiences firsthand in observing the complex interaction between science and politics. There will always be a temptation for anyone advocating any cause to exploit the changing nature of scientific understanding, to cherry pick that part of science that will prove them right. And there's a growing tendency to use uncertainty, which is a characteristic of both science and everyday life, as an excuse to avoid taking action. It's most evident now in the debate over climate change, where those who resist climate change, recognizing, I believe, the absurdity of the position that there's no climate change, have now subtly but gradually shifted to a position that the science is in dispute, that not every scientist agree, and therefore we can't act until there is unanimity. The reality, of course, is there will never be unanimity, and it's also true that if we wait until we get somewhere close to it, the damage will have been done. In fact, it's easy and common to blur the distinction between facts and beliefs, and to use science as a pawn in political debates that really are differences in beliefs. So I share Roger's view that society would benefit greatly from increased emphasis on using science to examine a range of options for solving complex problems, not to impose an outcome, but to suggest broadly acceptable outcomes, to enhance the ability of decision makers to evaluate the trade-offs of the various options. Now, this approach asks much of science and of the academic institutions in which so much research and scholarly work is conducted. It asks scientists and other scholars to focus more of their attention on understanding and helping to solve the complex but practical problems we face every day. This approach also requires emphasis on building relationships with diverse partners based on open communication, trust, and mutual respect. Such engagement increases the potential for developing a shared understanding of the problem, the first step toward a solution, and then to find viable solutions. This honest broker role is likely to be especially useful in addressing the need for sustainable development, I believe one of the most pressing issues of our time. The central goal of sustainable development is to increase human well-being, particularly for those living in poverty, in ways that also protect the planet's life support systems, so current generations can meet their needs without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. Although the meaning of the term continues to evolve, I believe the essence of sustainable development is its focus on the type of world we want to leave for future generations. How can we make decisions that result in a strong economy, in thriving communities, and a healthy environment? How do we balance the need for change and continuity in our policies and our politics? And how can we ensure that future generations have more opportunities than we do, not fewer? It's particularly gratifying for me to see that the University of Maine and this Center for Sustainability Solutions in particular have emerged as leaders in the development of innovative ways to tackle sustainability. For nearly a decade, hundreds of students and faculty working with the center have been focused not just on diagnosing the causes of sustainability problems, but helping to solve them. They've built productive collaborations with many stakeholder organizations representing local, state, federal governments, business and industry, and citizens and consumer groups. They've created interdisciplinary teams with a range of knowledge that matches the multifaceted nature of sustainability challenges, including expertise right here at this university in this center, expertise in economics, engineering, law, environmental science, and communication. The diversity of expertise helps ensure that solutions are crafted in ways that minimize the unintended consequences that arise when economic goals are pursued without regard to their environmental consequences, or vice versa, and addresses the reality that the solution to every human problem contains within itself the seeds of a new problem. I commend the many students, faculty, and university leaders who've worked hard to develop this unique problem-solving capacity. More than 20 research teams have used these novel approaches to tackle a range of challenges, including municipal planning, forest management, water quality, solid waste, climate adaptation, agriculture, renewable energy, and food insecurity. All of them serious, daily life problems among our people. Similar programs are now underway at other colleges and universities throughout the state and are spreading beyond Maine in conjunction with the New England Sustainability Consortium that this center is helping to lead. Project by project, partnership by partnership, they're demonstrating the value that higher education can bring to society beyond the direct knowledge of the individuals trained here by engaging with citizens and officials at the local level. They don't assert that the university has all the answers. They appreciate the tremendous value of the real-world experience and know-how of those with whom they deal, not all of whom have had the privilege of a college education. They aren't promising quick fixes. They understand that the road to solutions can be long and winding, and success requires patience, persistence, and most of all, humility and a respect for others, all others with whom we engage. This quest to make a difference, to give back to society, has always been the most rewarding part of my work. In the Senate, chairing the peace process in Northern Ireland, creating the college scholarship program that Mary mentioned, I believe in the importance of public service. So the ethos of this center, working together to help build a better world, is mine as well. I believe the long-term rewards of such work will far more than outweigh the many difficulties involved. By articulating a common vision, by establishing broad-based partnerships, by focusing on the needs of others, by listening to the people we are trying to help, we can create a better future here in Maine and hopefully, ultimately, in the nation and the world. Thank you all again for being here, for your support.
Senator George Mitchell, who is preceded by University of Colorado Professor Roger Pelkey Jr. here on Speaking in Maine. Time restraints have forced us to trim the end of the talk, which includes a question and answer portion with Senator Mitchell. You can, however, find the full version on our website, mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab for audio on demand. Charles Beck is our executive producer. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.